The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic that I chose for this morning is truth. And it's a topic that is very dear to me. If I put it very, very simply, if we could all figure out from one moment to the next, what is truth, we would be enlightened. So important. So even just right now, to just check in with ourselves and is what is true for me right now? This is all what mindfulness is about, right? It's just reminding ourselves of being able to perceive reality. What is true in the moment. So the topic of truth has many facets. And the facet that I have chosen to speak this morning is the facet of how we come to religious beliefs, opinions, views. So there is a particular discourse or sutta called the Chanki Sutta, where the Buddha talks about how to safeguard truth, how to discover truth, and how to arrive to truth. Three very distinct stages in our development. Now, as I looked at this discourse over time, I realized, oh, this is very interesting. The Buddha in this discourse at no time talks about what the beliefs are, but more how we get to our beliefs and how do we hold our beliefs, which is quite different. There are other discourses where he talks about the beliefs of the time and what he thinks is worthy of having faith in and whatnot. But here is really all about making us aware, how do we get to our beliefs? And then how do we hold them? So the Chanki Sutta, which will form really the base, that's where I'm departing from, I'll describe a little bit of how it's presented. The sutta is in a form of a dialogue, and it's a dialogue between the Buddha and a young Brahmin. This young man called Kapatika, just by being a Brahmin, it has a lot of power, you know, and as you know, this power comes just by birth, or that's the way it used to be in India. So Kapatika is very learned in the Vedas. And the Vedas are religious texts that at the time of the Buddha were considered like the authority for the Brahmins, the religious authority. And Kapatika asks the Buddha what he thinks about the Brahmin's claim on the Vedas, stating, and the Brahmins say the following about the Vedas: this is the truth, and everything else is false. So the Buddha, instead of right out contradicting Kapatika, responds by asking the young Brahmin a question. And I quote, "Is there a single Brahmin among those who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, everything else is false?" Kapatika answers, no. And he answers no because he recognizes that what the Buddha is doing with his question is that he is pointing towards the personal direct experience. I know this. I see this. So Kapatika then says, the Brahmins go by faith. But the Buddha replies that this kind of faith is groundless because it is not based on direct experience. Then Kapatika adds, the Brahmins not only go by faith alone, but they also go on oral tradition. So here the Buddha at this point basically answers, well, young man, first you're trying to make an argument by faith, and now by oral tradition. So this is just a detail, but I like this response of the Buddha because this is a training of our mind. This is a training to make us aware. How do we think? Kapatika, that he has switched his mode of argument. And then the Buddha goes on to present five grounds of which faith and oral tradition are part of. And he says these five grounds can lead to two kinds of results right here and now. So that's important to know. These five grounds that are faith, personal preference, oral tradition, reason, thought, and reflective acceptance can go in two directions. So what the Buddha is doing is he pointing out that these five grounds are not capable to yielding certainty because they can lead either to truth or to falseness. So these five grounds by themselves, the Buddha warns, are insufficient or inadequate for safeguarding the truth. Because one arrives to one-sided assertions, something a wise person wouldn't do. So what we have here with the example of Kapatika, the Brahmin, is an example of what the Buddha called a traditionalist. And the traditionalists are those who base their belief on scriptural tradition, which of course includes interpretations and oral tradition. The Buddha, on the other hand, and it becomes more and more apparent as we go on with the sutta, represents the experientialists, those who know the teachings directly for themselves. So what we have here is we're juxtaposing belief and knowledge. The heart of this discourse are three questions that Kapatika poses to the Buddha. The first one being, what way is there of safeguarding the truth? So he's kind of understood that there is something faulty on the way he's looking at things. And so here's his first question, how do we safeguard truth? And the way the Buddha answers is that he takes these five grounds that I just read to you, this list of five grounds, and he says this. I quote, my faith is thus, but does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. In this way, he, she preserves the truth. But as yet, there is no discovery of truth. This he repeats, as is often in the discourses, the same, but just exchanging faith for each of the five. Yeah, so approval or oral tradition, reason, thought, reflective acceptance. So basically the Buddha is saying that everyone is entitled to an opinion. But to go on and proclaim that everyone must adhere to one's opinion or view, that does not safeguard truth. The teacher Pia Tan says, as long as we do not have a direct personal experience of those opinions or views, they will turn out to be either true or false. This is the most important rationale for religious tolerance and interfaith. I particularly want to stress this last part. The important rationale for religious tolerance and interfaith. This is huge. This points to having respect for others. This sets the base for world peace and for wisdom, really, for each one of us. So now we get to the next question. And the Buddha has told him clearly that he has not yet discovered truth. And so then, of course, the next logical question Kapatika poses is, in what way is there to discover truth? So here the Buddha goes on to say that at this point we need to step in and begin an investigation. An investigation of who we're going to bestow our faith. And the example that the Buddha gives is very descriptive of his times, and of course some Asian countries, of a lay person that comes in contact with a monastic, let's say in a village, by offering food. By this proximity, the lay person can then examine the monastic. Is he, she free from greed, hatred, and delusion? If this monastic is not free from greed, hatred, and delusion, he would claim, I see, when he doesn't see. He or she will claim, I know, when he or she doesn't know. The Buddha then adds, this Dharma cannot easily be taught by one affected by greed, hatred, or delusion. So this scenario we can also apply for ourselves, for choosing a teacher, finding a teacher. We take our time to ascertain if this person is worthy of our trust, of our faith. We take our time to find out, does this person live according to what he or she teaches? I see this aspect of being able to place our faith on a teacher as the beginning of our journey. And it is interesting how the Buddha uses this explanation of how to find a teacher as the first step of a gradual teaching that is comprised of 12 steps. And the first step is faith. Pia Tan describes his teaching as a 12-step psychology of learning. So the way that this list is presented is an interesting way. It's presented in a dialogical form. So after the Buddha presents each step, Kapatika asks, and what is the most helpful way for, let's say, faith, which is the first step? What is the most helpful for faith? And then the Buddha responds with the next step, by visiting the teacher, he says, and thereby introduces the next step. So each consecutive step in this list is the best way to cultivate the previous one. So as I was looking at this list of 12, so well, a good way of making it a little more organized is divided it up in groups. And they actually group themselves very nicely in three groups of four. So the first group, as I looked at it, is really all about encountering the teachings and opening ourselves to the teachings. And it comprises, what it comprises in this first four steps is faith, which in this particular case is faith in the teacher, and then visiting the teacher, respectfully drawing near and lending ear. So what I want to do for the rest of the talk is just talk about some of these, not all, but almost all of these 12 points. And I will do so in saying how do they relate, how I have related to them, and how have they informed my practice. I wanted to do this because sometimes we can fall into just talking about theory, and one aspect that I find important about truth is once you read the teaching, to step back and to say, what's true for me? How can I make it relevant for me? So the first one, faith in the teacher. I have developed faith or confidence, some of us prefer the term confidence, in my teachers slowly over many, many years. I've been trying out their suggestions, and repeatedly I've had the experience, a very lovely experience, of having the Dharma prove itself to me. The first time I heard that expression, I thought, oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. But when you hear about a teaching, and then you actually experience it, you say, oh, it is true. Then the Dharma has really proven itself to you. So my teachers have also functioned as a role model, showing me what is possible. And thereby, I have not only developed faith in my teachers, but also in the teachings themselves, and most importantly, in myself. And this happens very, very gradually, almost imperceptibly. I like very much the image that we're presented with in the Dharma to show this slow progress. The image is of a rope that is left outside to be worn out by the wind and the sun and the water. And over the years, maybe you don't see it from one week to the next, but over 10 years, you see a big difference in how this rope has been worn out. So sometimes I'm surprised to remember how certain situations used to upset me terribly. And now I notice that it doesn't happen anymore. But mainly I notice the difference by looking back over several years. So cultivating faith is an ongoing process, and it requires renewal. Part of this renewal is visiting the teacher. So we come to the next step. So in the time of the Buddha, the only way to listen to teachings was to make the effort to go and visit your teacher. Many of the discourses begin by an individual or a group of people taking the decision to go and visit the Buddha. In particular, the Chanki Sutta is one of them. At the beginning, we read that the Brahmin Chanki, together with several hundred people, make their way to visit the Buddha. So there is an unmistakable value in the personal transmission that occurs when we visit a teacher. I may read the Dharma and I may listen to Dharma talks online, but being in the presence of the teacher and the Sangha or community offers us something unique, very palpable and uplifting. Many years ago, When I first started with this practice, I was in the midst of the rigors of a PhD. And I would get swamped with work, and I would forget to come. I used to come Monday nights, and so I would stay away for several weeks, and then I would come back. And I remember how I would sit in the meditation, and suddenly I would just feel tears running down my cheeks. And it was really out of a combination of relief and joy of being back. And then the question would come up, it's like, why have I stayed away for so long? So I needed the reminder of coming back. So the next step, respectfully drawing near. The first thing that came to my mind is the image that is so often described in the suttas. When people from all kinds of social strata come to visit the Buddha, they always begin by paying respect to him and then sit to his side before they engage him in a conversation. So the activity of respectfully drawing near is a kind of a spiritual closeness. And how does it express this respectfully drawing near? Well, if our teacher happens to be a monastic, then it implies that we are sensitive to the monastic rules. For example, as a female student, I will not expect to sit just with one male monastic and have a one-on-one conversation in a room with a closed door. It's just not done. There has to be a third person present. Within our lay teacher's world, the way I interpret this aspect of respect is the attitude I bring to the hearing and receiving of the Dharma. It helps to remind myself that it is a noble endeavor from the side of the teacher and the student to share the same goal, the attainment of truth and liberation. Another thought that came to me, that in our lay world, it also points to the need to respect our teacher's private life. Sharing the Dharma puts us in a rather intimate space with our teachers. And it is important not to confuse this intimacy. And with this, we get to the last one in this first group, which is giving ear. So for me, it's very important to set the intention when I come here to be fully present. And that means that I need to take care of myself before so I can be as receptive as possible. You know, our lives are so hectic that sometimes our bodies make it to IMC, but our minds are still somewhere else. When we sit to meditate, we notice how we are exhausted, we're hungry, our minds are all over the place. So thank goodness we have the meditation before the Dharma talk, which allows us for the mind, you know, this agitated mind, to slowly settle and for our bodies to renew. A couple years ago, I had a conversation with a Catholic priest who incorporates meditation in his practice. And I was very struck by a comment he made. He said, "You know, you are very lucky to be able to present the teachings to people after they have meditated. You see," he said, "they are so much more receptive In my experience, it is not so during Mass when I present the gospel. Which is interesting. You know, I went to Mass all my childhood. It never occurred to me that this silence that we share at the beginning is a tremendous gift to make us receptive, to make us settle in ourselves. So at another very, very basic level, but I think it's important to mention in our time, it also means leaving our phones and all our technical devices outside of the meditation hall. I actually have experienced it here of giving a Dharma talk and having somebody text while the Dharma talk. So that we're definitely not giving ear when that's happening. So this is the end of the first group. The second group is all about, to me, is all about learning and understanding. In this group, we have hearing the Dharma, remembering the Dharma, investigating the meaning, and reflective acceptance of the teachings. So I'll skip hearing the Dharma, which is very close to the previous one. So memorizing, sometimes it's translated as remembering the Dharma. Memorizing, as I think most of you know, was an essential component at the time of the Buddha. That was a way of passing on the teachings from one generation to the next. It was through oral tradition. But for us, as I thought about it, memorizing is not something that we do very much. I had a little bit of an experience. I lived in a community for 2 years, and there was one monastic. And every morning and evening, we did chanting. And we did the chanting of the five subjects of frequent recollections. So I found that chanting is an excellent way of memorizing the teachings. There's something about the sing-song that allows the memory to retain it. And I found that after repeated chanting, I had memorized parts of it. It was very powerful and of great support, because these teachings would arise spontaneously right at the moment, at the pertinent moment when I needed them. I would say that for us, most of the time is more about remembering the teachings in general, not memorizing, but just remembering certain teachings that might come of help at particular moments. So the next one examines or investigates their meaning. This one is a very important one for us. The process of making these teachings ours. I find there is quite a space and a difference between, for me, reading the Dharma, hearing the Dharma, and then really saying, well, what does it mean to me? How do I really understand it? How does it apply to my life? How can I make these teachings come alive in my life? So in my experience, these questions take time. It requires patience and persistence and humility, you know, to allow these questions to be answered at the right time. Sometimes I'm aware of being just a bit greedy when I'm reading the suttas, and I want to get to the depth of it on the first reading, and I see my body leaning forward. There's a bit of attention there, and that's greed. So, you know, it's always this reminder of come back. We can tell when it's greed if there's tension. There can be the wholesome aspiration, of course, of wanting to understand the Dharma, but then it would feel very different in the body. The body would feel centered, soft, open, receptive. And then I allow the teachings to be able to reveal themselves to me at their own time, not my ego's timing. There are some words that I very much admire and get a lot of inspiration from, words that the Buddha spoke shortly after his enlightenment. And he said, "This Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise." And I think for most of us, this part about that is not attainable by mere reasoning is important. And also important with this topic of truth, right? The truth involves so much more. Reasoning is a part of it, and yes, it is important, but it's not all of it. The next one, the last one in this second group, is reflective acceptance of the teachings. And here I just very briefly want to say that the concept would change completely if it would say acceptance of the teachings, because that implies passivity. But what we need to stress here is reflective acceptance of the teachings. So for me, it implies that I get engaged. I really apply myself, make effort to understand, to reflect, and then I accept. In the last group, the last four, these four, I think, to me, are all about being the Dharma. And they are willpower, exertion, weighing, and striving. So I'll speak about willpower and exertion together. And by the way, exertion sometimes gets translated also as zeal. So here is, to me, all about a strong, enthusiastic engagement in our quest for truth. And the exertion here is a wholesome desire. It's what we call in Pali chanda, wholesome desire. So we exert ourselves in the cultivation of mindfulness, which, as I mentioned before, is the base for discovering what's real in the moment, what is true from moment to moment. So the image that I got from applying our will with zeal is that of a sailboat where the sails catch the wind and we are propelled forward effortlessly. A way of keeping this zeal, this application of our will and exertion alive, is a reminder of impermanence. I don't want to lose time because I don't know how long I have to be healthy and to be able to practice. So the penultimate one is scrutinizes. So scrutiny is all about our ability to examine and discern. Discern to be able to distinguish what leads us to truth and happiness and what leads us to falseness and suffering. just the simple, but we know it's not simple to carry it out. And the last one, striving. Striving in our Western world has a very kind of forward-leaning, tension, ego-driven connotation. But to me, it's pointing more at our ability, our willingness to go beyond what is known, what is comfortable for us. Can we always challenge ourselves gently, little bit at a time, to stretch ourselves? And in order not to get tensed about this with striving, I think it's very important not to get contracted and attached to a particular outcome. So with striving, we arrive to the end of this 12-step list and how to gradually discover the truth. And I'll share with you a quote that is presented at the end of this list. With a striving mind, an individual realizes the ultimate truth with his, her own body. One sees true reality by penetrating it with wisdom. In this way, there is the discovery of truth. I'll read this again. With a striving mind, an individual realizes the ultimate truth with his or her own body. One sees true reality by penetrating it with wisdom. In this way, there is the discovery of truth. But as yet, there is no final arrival at truth. So there is yet one more stage. And that, of course, now is going to be presented by the question of Kapatika, who asks, how do we get to the final arrival of truth? And just very briefly, I'll tell you what happens in this last section. The Buddha does something very interesting with this list. The way he answers Kapatika for the final arrival of truth is that he takes this list and reverses it. And what does that mean? Why does he do that? So it's interesting that now then striving is at the beginning, pointing to the fact that even after final arrival, which is here equated with liberation, we continue to strive. And faith, which was the first step in the early stages of our training, it is also now going to be the end. So faith is the beginning, faith is the beginning and the end. Now, because the final arrival of truth is now pointing towards liberation, faith at the end of our training will look very, very different than at the beginning. Faith most likely would be at the end now a confidence in ourselves, full confidence in ourselves. We just need to remember the Buddha in the night of his enlightenment, when Mara comes and tempts him, and there is this tremendous confidence in him, and he just doesn't go along. He knows. And he tempts him by questioning. He says, who are you? That's the one that would get us all. Who are you? Why do you think you're worth being enlightened? That's the confidence. That's the confidence and faith that is being pointed here at the very end of this long journey. So I want to finish by sharing a poem with you from a collection called the Terigata. It is a poem by one of the early Buddhist nuns. And as you hear it, remember how the Buddha spoke at the beginning of this sutta about the meaning of I know, I see, that brings us all the way to the arrival of truth. Wandering for alms, weak, leaning on a staff, with trembling limbs, I fell down, right there on the ground, seeing the drawbacks of the body. My mind was then set free. I read it again. Wandering for alms, weak, leaning on a staff, with trembling limbs, I fell down right there on the ground, seeing the drawbacks of the body. My mind was then set free. So let's take a minute to be in silence. So thank you very much, and enjoy the potluck.